Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Stew Pod. Killer Mike Oz is on vacation this week, and so we have a special guest joining me today. You know me, of course, as Chris Swick, and our special guest is all-around Twitter personality slash sandwich aficionado slash writer for Baseball Prospectus slash purveyor of the FoxSports.com power rankings. It's Craig Goldstein. Craig, how are you?
I'm wonderful, and thank you for having me. How are you, Chris?
I'm doing great. Did I cover all the things that you're an expert at in the intro there?
Well, you know, clout.com, which is an extremely useful tool when you're concerned about your brand, has said that I'm also an expert at British Petroleum. So,
all right. Well, that's not exactly what we do here, so maybe we'll just focus on the baseball aspect of your expertise. And so, everyone who's listened, you guys know how it works. We have some questions to go over with Craig about just some of the major storylines going on right now. This week, we have an interview with Molly Knight, author of The Best Team Money Can Buy. Craig was not around for that, so that will just be me for that, and then we will come back with Craig and do everyone's favorite segment, The Important Questions. So, Craig, let's get started. And I think the biggest thing happening this week that we have to talk about is the MVP race in the American League. Mike Trout, Josh Donaldson, neck and neck. One is passing the other in war every day. RBIs are such a big part of this conversation. Who do you like right now, and how have you come to that determination? What methods are you using?
I think, you know, at this point, I'm going to say Mike Trout. But I think, you know, anyone reasonable would say, you look at the year Josh Donaldson's having, you know, hitting 300, 581 slugging. He's got 34 home runs. It's an incredible year. And if you wanted to tell me and rant at me that Josh Donaldson deserves the MVP, I'm not going to disagree with you. I think Trout has, you know, he's on level in terms of slugging. He's a little bit better, in fact, and he's a few points better in OBP as well. So overall, I think offensively, that's where I'm at. If you look at Fangraphs WAR, they're essentially equal. Josh Donaldson has a 0.1 advantage, which, you know, we're not even a full season. It's not even a full season of WAR. And then on top of that, there's a fairly significant error bar in WAR. So, you know, the difference between 7.0, which is Trout, and 7.1, which is Donaldson, is, I mean, they might, you know, an accurate estimator might actually have Trout ahead. We don't really know. But the point is that they're both great. And the thing that kind of pushes me one way and that way is towards Trout is that, so mainly when it comes to WAR, people use Baseball Reference and Fangraphs. Those are the general types of WAR that people use. BP, where I work, has something called WARP, which is WAR with a P on the end. And that has Donaldson at 6.2 and Mike Trout at 7.7, which is a massive gap, obviously, even with a fairly significant error bar. And the bulk of that is made up in a difference in their defensive metrics, which are extremely hazy. So again, this is why I wouldn't argue one way or the other in a major way. But I do think that BP has a good grasp on defense relative to UZR or plus minus or whatever you want to use. And that given that it has a major edge towards Trout, I'll go with Trout.
I think the thing that separates him for me, at least right now, is probably the OBP advantage for Trout. It's, I think, roughly 20 points higher at this point, but everything else is so close. And like you said, the defensive components are hazy. And I know, like, the Fangraphs WAR has Donaldson being a fairly elite defender at his position. From the eye test, I kind of agree with that. And I've seen a lot of his plays this year. I feel like he has range. So I guess what I'm saying is I wish that I could find a bigger discrepancy in the defense so that I can make the decision. Because this is honestly, it's neck and neck to me as well. I feel like you can't if I picked Donaldson, or if I wanted to pick Donaldson and you had picked Trout, I really can't argue with you, like you were saying, because it's so close.
I think you know, fortunately, we're lucky enough to have a year in which we have, you know, two really deserving candidates. And, you know, it kind of kills me inside to use a defensive metric to make the difference, which is what I'm doing essentially by picking WARP instead of, you know, Fangraphs or Baseball Reference. And like you said, I mean, Donaldson's an elite defender at third base and has been. He doesn't have a gold glove, but he'll probably get it this year since he's hitting well enough to get one. But, you know, he's an elite defender at third. Trout is a very good defensive center fielder. There's a little bit more value in being a center fielder than a third baseman, just in terms of what's built into the metrics in terms of positional value. But, you know, if you're going to tell me that an elite third baseman is worth more defensively than a well above average center fielder, I'm not sure I'd argue with you. That there's a lot of value on both sides.
Right. All right. Well, I think we've settled that for now. We still have September, so
we're both actually going with Nelson Cruz, right?
Well, you know, I think we're going to wind up looking at the voting at the end of the year and then looking at his offensive numbers and feeling like he got a little bit robbed. Just because his numbers are insane.
I hate to say this, but I think you're right.
Yeah, but and I say that knowing that Trout and Donaldson are far more deserving. I just feel like you're going to look at Cruz's offensive numbers and be like, how did he get two votes?
Right, right. How is he not even really involved?
Right. All right, so let's shift gears here. We should probably cover the New York Yankees, where I'm just going to say flat out, panic on the streets of New York. Everyone should maybe be afraid right now. They just got beat by the Astros, a huge drubbing last night, and then today they also dropped another game. So we're looking at the Yankees. We're looking at that division. The Blue Jays have been exceptionally hot lately and have really put the pressure on. How concerned are you about the Yankees, and how concerned should they be about making the playoffs? They might have a better chance, but contending for this division and getting themselves a three-game series.
Well, a five-game series,
yes.
Yeah, I think, you know, that they, having a four-game lead on the top wild card at this point is relatively comfortable. It might not feel that way, and it sucks to have a whole season go by and then come down to one game, and that's, you know, that is what it is. But by our playoff odds at BP, which is what power rankings that I write comments for, they're 93.5% chance entering today to make the playoffs. So that's before today's results. That's a really good rate, obviously. It's extremely high, but it's also, I think, let me see here. It's one of, I think, the top five. Sorry, no, it's seventh in baseball. So, you know, I don't think that they should be panicking in terms of making the playoffs, but this is obviously not the way that they would want things to go. And, you know, there's so, because of the added wild card, there's so much value in winning the division and not having your season come down to a one game playoff that, you know, I think anything less than a division win at this point is considered a disappointment. And I think there's some understanding in that the Blue Jays have been fantastic. But when you were as far ahead as they were, I think it was, what, five games, when the Blue Jays went on this run, and now they're 1.5 back, you know, that's going to be a disappointment. You know, that said, there's no one really that close on the wild card. The Rangers hold the second wild card, and they're 4 back of them. And, after that, it's the Twins, Angels, and Orioles, and I don't think any of those teams really have a shot of pulling something off.
Well, I've kind of doubted the Yankees all year. I picked them to finish last in that division before the year, so I look like an idiot already.
I picked the Royals to finish.
That as well. So I think the Yankees have kind of shocked me all year. I feel like they should be panicked only because I almost never really believed in their run to the top. So...
The counter argument to that, though, is that what's powered them for the most part is a healthy Alex Rodriguez mm-hmm. and a healthy Mark Teixeira, both of which are still in place.
True. But I also worry just about age for both of those guys and Teixeira's injury history. I mean, that's been a big concern for me.
Yeah. So. Oh, I mean, that's why people knocked them down right. before the season. You were assuming maybe 40 missed games from Teixeira, and Rodriguez was a total wild card. Mm-hmm. I highlight those two names. It's not like they haven't had contributions from anywhere else, but those are their two premium offensive performers. And they have, you know, the problem is that their entire lineup is old, except for Didi Gregorius, who can't hit.
Right.
But, you know, I think Nate Eovaldi's been not as good as his record, but recently with his splitter mm-hmm. has been really good. You know, they're getting a little bit healthier. I think I had heard Pineda was coming back soonish. I don't know if it was immediate, but, you know, they're getting healthy. And the upside for them is that they really only have to throw six innings or so, and then their bullpen gets to take over.
All right, so it sounds like both of us, even if we don't think they're going to win the division, the hold on the first wild card spot is probably going to that team that loses out in the East. What about the second wild card division? You kind of teased this a little bit during the Yankees segment. The Rangers lead the way right now, and that's somewhat inconceivable to me since this was not a team I even thought about until about last week.
You were talking to the right guy because yeah, apparently. I have been talking about them since early June.
All right, so are they holding on to this spot? And if not, who the heck is going to make that run?
So this is the thing. I've been on Twitter calling them the team of destiny since very early June. And the impetus behind that was essentially that at that point, Joey Gallo was up in the majors and pretty much everything had gone wrong. They were still, you know, they lost Yu Darvish for the year. They were still missing. Why am I blanking on it? They were missing a bunch of players, which is why Gallo had to be up right. in the first place. I think Beltre was hurt.
Beltre got hurt.
He came up to play third base, and then they shifted him to the outfield because they had guys banged up there. Leonis Martin has been atrocious, and awful. He's still in the minors now. I mean, everything had gone wrong. Martin Perez was still hurt. Derek Holland not back yet. All of this stuff. And yet they were, like, within shouting distance of .500 a lot, maybe reaching it and falling back under. Rougned Odor had been atrocious. And then when he came back up, he's been a monster since then. The reason that I kind of started saying this was because I foresaw just their depth was so significant, and that they were going to be getting Martin Perez back. They were going to be getting Derek Holland back. Adrian Beltre was going to be healthy. And then, even now, should they need him in September, they're going to be able to call upon Joey Gallo. That's, I mean, how many teams can just reach down and pluck up a Joey Gallo if they, in terms of power, if they need him? You know, if they need a boost off the bench, even if they just need a three-run homer to win a game, like, that's your best shot, you know? You're not going to find that many better people in terms of changing a game with one swing than Gallo, and they're not even using him consistently right now. You know, so then they go ahead and trade for Cole Hamels, and it makes sense in terms of a long-term thing. You know, you get Hamels and Darvish in 2016, but there's still that non-zero chance that they were going to continue on this path in 2015, and lo and behold, that's kind of come to fruition. And the other teams, you know, this is what you mentioned. The other teams, I mean, when we're talking Minnesota, we're talking Anaheim, and talking Baltimore, I don't see any of them as significantly better than Texas or any reason that Texas can't do this. It doesn't mean they will. You know, there's a half game separating the Rangers and then Minnesota and Anaheim. You know, that's not a lot. So it in that sense, you know, anything can happen. But I think on raw talent, the Rangers are better than the Twins, and the Angels overall might be comparable or even a little bit better, but they have so many significant holes in different areas that it's really hard for me to to count on them to put anything together.
Yeah, I feel like the whole second wild card in the AL is just kind of this dumpster fire of teams. I think the Rays, I think I was looking today, and they were only 2.5 games out somehow. The White Sox are 5 games out, and they've been atrocious this year. So
right.
I think the Rangers are now, they've now become kind of the fun story, just because I don't think anyone really anticipated them doing this until about a week ago. And I feel except for you, of course. And so you could make a similar argument for the Angels. You could probably make a similar argument for the Twins. And I would find fault in all of them, but I feel like I wouldn't think any is necessarily stronger than the other. I feel like all these teams kind of have an equal amount of weaknesses, I guess is what I'm trying to say at this point.
But I do think, you know, the Twins were at one point, 11 games over 500.
Right.
And they've kind of fallen back. They're now 3 games over on the strength of a 5-game winning streak. But, you know, who's their pitcher that you're...
No, you're right. You're right.
Where's their pitching? And I'd say the same for the Angels. You know, the Angels got a huge boost through the first half of the season from a guy like Hector Santiago, who's been, you know, he's seen his ERA go from, I think it was, you know, in the 2.3 range in, you know, through July or into July, and kind of his last 5 starts or 6 starts, he's had an ERA closer to 5, you know? So when those kind of things start going backwards for the Angels, they don't really have a frontline guy to, you know, to save the bullpen, to stop a losing streak. I mean, Jared Weaver's been good since being healthy, but I struggle to believe that he's, you know, a right-handed version of Jamie Moyer in the sense that he can pitch 84 to 86 and be fine.
Yeah, and I feel like that the CJ Wilson injury really hurt them because he was pitching better than I expected, and now suddenly
second. Doing enough that you could buy into, and then with that injury and Santiago's regression, you're kind of like, where are those two pitchings? You know, they optioned Matt Shoemaker. So where are those arms coming from? Heaney's been pretty good. Garrett Richards is very good. But, you know, that's 2 pitchers and Weaver. So what, 2.5 or 3 at best? It's just it's hard to figure out where that's coming from.
All right. So let's shift to our final question here. I feel like we have to ask you about prospects. You're a prospects guy. You've done a lot of work at BP. You know, concerning some of the younger players in the game. We've seen such a huge explosion this year. I think it's probably, we see these guys, they come up, and this year especially, it seems like they've dominated right away. Some guys, it's taken them a while to adjust, and so I'm wondering who in your mind has maybe been overlooked a little bit this year, or maybe who's been up and struggled who you still believe in. You want to tell the fans, hey, calm down, this guy's going to be just fine.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the names is a guy I've already talked about, which is Joey Gallo. And it's hard for me to even say he struggled. He had, you know, a 754 OPS, which is 3% better than league average in his 25 games. But he did hit 218. His on-base was 306, which relative to his batting average is pretty good, but on the whole, not so much. He really subsisted on power and power alone. And that is kind of, that's his flaw, but that's also his, like, that's the positive with him. It's kind of a feature and a bug. And he definitely, he has an approach. He just has an incredibly long swing that's going to result in a lot of swings and misses. And when you don't put the ball in play as often, you don't give yourself a chance to, you know, get those fluky bad whip hits or what have you. So, I mean, he's made it work for him his whole career. And I think he can adjust to the point that he's a regularly above average player. But, you know, this was always something of the risk, even though it still results in a league average OPS in that sense. I do think he can grow kind of at the major league level, be it in September, as we talked about before, or just in 2016 and beyond. Another name in that sense is Addison Russell. And, you know, he's someone who has not lit the world on fire, you know, from the get-go, but he's been, especially given his defense, he's kind of been as advertised, I think. And it's hard to argue with, you know, he's hitting 249. Again, the slugging and OBP aren't great, but this is, you know, a lot of people expect finished products from prospects once they get called up. That's the team saying they're ready. But, you know, the kind of the chorus that happens in the prospect world is that, you know, development isn't linear. And I think a corollary to that is that development does not stop when you reach the majors. People change and adapt. And one of the biggest things for prospects to do is be able to adjust to the league adjusting to them, right? You always have, you know, when you're an unknown quantity, people might be willing to challenge you until you turn on an inside fastball at 97. Once you show you can do that, especially consistently, people are going to say, okay, I'm not going to throw him 97 on the inside. He's proven that. Let me go soft stuff away. And until you prove you can react to that, at a competent level, they're just going to keep doing it and exploit your weaknesses. So, you know, I think those are two examples of guys who have struggled in terms of maybe relative to expectations. Mm-hmm. And but there are guys who do it naturally. I mean, this is a year that I don't think there are any prospects left in the minors at this point. So many people have been so good. I mean, Carlos Correa is... I mean, the Rangers kind of have to make this count this year because they have to face Carlos Correa and Mike Trout for like the next 6 years. it's not really fair. But a guy I think who's not mentioned as much, who has been extremely good since his call up, is Francisco Lindor. You know, with Russell and Correa and Lindor, we kind of have this bevy of shortstop prospects. And we're really spoiled with it right now. I mean, entering today, you know, today's games, Lindor's hitting 306, 341, 433. And what he was known for coming up through the minors is his superlative defense. So you've got a guy with a 773 OPS from playing shortstop and not only, you know, just standing there, but playing it extremely well. So he's someone that, I mean, that's one of the more valuable players in baseball if he did that over the course of a full year. And he's done it over the course of 63 games. So it's not, I mean, it's still small sample size, but it's not nothing. So right. He's, you know, if you're looking for a reason to watch the Indians, and God knows you need to look for one at this point, he's a really good one.
All right. Well, Craig, you survived the first segment. I think we're going to toss it over to my interview with Molly Knight now, and Craig and I will be right back. You are listening to the Stew Pod.
Welcome back to the Stew Pod. I am Chris Swick, and today we're joined by Molly Knight, author of The Best Team Money Can Buy. Molly, thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
So, first things first, I love the book. I can't give it a higher recommendation. I tore through the whole thing. I guess I should mention that it covers the Dodgers of the last couple seasons, it covers their ownership change, and just the team in general. And my first question for you, Molly, is when did you decide that you were going to write this book? Was it when ownership changed? Was it when they made the huge trade with the Red Sox? Was there one moment that stood out to you where you said, all right, I'm just doing this?
No, well, thank you for your kind words. First of all, that really means a lot to me. I guess for me, I'd been around during the McCourt divorce when I had seen how they were bankrupt and different players asking me if I knew if our checks were going to clear because they knew I was in the courthouse every day dealing with the bankruptcy stuff. So to see them from being in that moment of panic to, you know, 2 years or like a year later, they're making that trade with the Red Sox and they're signing Zach Greinke. I think it was when Greinke was signed, actually, that it was sort of like, okay, they have Kershaw and now they have Greinke, and usually teams with two pitchers that good have a great shot of winning the World Series. So a couple of players came to me after Greinke was signed and just said, you should write a book about us. We're going to go from bankrupt to World Series. That was before I even knew how obsessed I was going to become with Zach Greinke as the character. But I was kind of like, I'd never written a book before. So I was kind of like, oh yeah, whatever. Like I kind of, Moneyball had just come out. And so my feeling was that, the movie had just come out. And so my feeling was that, these guys all thought that Brad Pitt would play them in the movie or something, in the movie version of the book. But then, so the idea was there, I approached some guys and then 2013 season happened and they were terrible. I didn't want to do it. And then they were amazing in that 50 game run where they won 42 games and Puig came up. So it just sort of like solidified it at that moment that, yeah, I should write about this team.
So you mentioned Greinke and we're definitely going to talk about him, but I think one of the things, that I think you did really well was you got the players' personalities across. And I'm wondering if that was something you had kind of set out to do when you first started writing it, or if that's just something that happened because this team is kind of rich with those types of players.
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, I think for me, when I spent time around this team, I was there in 2013 reporting every day I could. I was still working at ESPN full time at that point. And I actually didn't sell the book until after the season ended. And the strategy was sort of, you know, usually with book proposals, you kind of say, this person might be interesting, this person might be interesting. But I was able to take concrete examples of what people had done, like that Greinke giving a speech in which he references bathroom hygiene and different things Puig had done that were hysterical and sad and weird and frustrating. And yeah, it was crazy. That group of guys, and you had Hanley Ramirez and Nat Kemp and Zach Greinke and Puig and Mattingly and Magic Johnson and Stan Kasten. I mean, it was sort of like lightning in a bottle. Not to mention, you know, Clayton Kershaw, the best pitcher on the planet. And so, yeah, I wanted to write a book about humans. And they were extraordinary humans to write about.
Well, yeah, you mentioned Kershaw, and your first, I think the prologue talks about mm-hmm. when you went to his house right before he signed his big contract extension. And yeah. Just reading that, I realized this guy's the best pitcher on the planet. I don't know a thing about him.
Right. Yeah.
So that was illuminating
to
me.
I didn't know a thing about him. Yeah. I mean, I was around the Dodgers a lot since he'd come up, but not every day. I was down there in spring training every year doing stuff for ESPN. And then when they sent me out to cover the bankruptcy trial, they sent me out to Los Angeles in 2010. So I was around a lot, but he's a really guarded guy. He's sort of, in a way, well, maybe not exactly the same, but kind of reminds me of like a Derek Jeter who will stand there and answer everybody's questions. It's not as though he blows media off. He never does that. He always like, you know, handles his responsibilities, but he doesn't give very personal answers. That's calculated. That's by design. He doesn't want to give up his privacy. So it took me a long time to, get him to kind of get him to trust me and let me in. And then he happened to open his door to me and invite me over. And then it happened to be that day that he got called that his contract was complete in the moment that I was there. So that was pretty, pretty crazy. I don't know if he'll have a reporter over again, but I think he was okay with how things worked out, but yeah, it was pretty crazy.
I think we also probably need to talk about Yasiel Puig. You cover his call up in the book. You also cover some of the issues surrounding him. And personally, I feel like you were pretty fair to him. I mean, it seems like you mm-hmm. painted a picture of a guy who definitely rubbed some teammates the wrong way, but also, you know, is trying to turn things around. It feels like you've gotten some criticism for
yeah.
Puig just because, I mean, that's who he is. He's going to invite the hot takes.
Right. I mean, I think part of that is just that the first stories that leaked from the book were pretty sensational about, you know, his conflict with teammates, and people just assumed that I had written some kind of Puig slam book, which is just not true at all. And I think the people who have actually read the book, like you said, they see that actually, like I'm a huge fan of Puig. I mean, of the way he plays. And you know, when I started reporting this book, I witnessed a lot of the different behavior by certain media members, and I witnessed some of the inherent racism in a lot of the columns that were written about him and things that were said by opposing fans, and I thought it really wasn't fair at all. And so when I started to write this book, I wanted to show what he was going through, what he had gone through to get here in having to escape a communist nation using with the help of a drug cartel who is now blackmailing him. That sort of pressure that the average American cannot possibly understand. But at the same time, I didn't want to sugarcoat, the fact that, like, okay, well, all these things happened to him, and yes, he was treated unfairly, and yes, there was a lot of racism that infected the way he was covered. But also, he was really frustrating, and he was really difficult for his teammates and for the organization. And I can't just blame my violin for him. I have to show both sides, and that was really tricky. And ultimately, I feel like I did a decent job. But yeah, some people who want me to book are just going to think that I hate Puig. So I'm going to have to do about that.
Well, I think maybe on the opposite end would be Zach Greinke, who is almost the breakout performer of the book in my mind. Just some of the stuff you hear about him. I mean, I think most fans know that he is an interesting guy as far as like his interviews and what he's willing to say. But I think getting a dose of some actual Zach Greinke stories kind of just illuminates how different this guy is from your average ball player.
Yeah, no, he is. And I think it was weird. I think for me, when I started this book, I really didn't know much about him more than what has been reported about his social anxiety. And he was kind of different, and you didn't really like talking to reporters. And he was someone who, it took me a long time he basically vetted me, and it took the better part of a year. I've been trying to get a sit down with him for the better part of a year. He just doesn't really do that. He'll talk after games to reporters in the scrum, but he doesn't do like sit down interviews. And he basically background checked me. He read old stories. He went to my Twitter feed. He asked different teammates. I just think he doesn't want to waste his time if he doesn't think that it's time well spent. He wants to make sure that the person he's talking to knows about baseball and can have an intelligent conversation about baseball. And then once, I guess he was assured that would be the case, and that I wasn't just some sort of like tabloid reporter. He walked up to me one day out of nowhere. I hadn't spoken to him in maybe a couple of months. But okay, I've got 15 minutes. and that was great. We sat down and talked about basically everything. And he's just a really, really interesting, pure guy. And his teammates are obsessed with him. I think that he's really kind of coming into his own this year. People have seen that. People have seen he's grown his hair out. He was walking up to Careless Whisper for a while. I think he's sort of embracing his inner weirdo, and it's really working for him. Look at him. He's got a sub-2 ERA at this point. And frankly, it's inspirational because a lot of us might not feel like we always fit in or feel like totally comfortable in social situations. I think a lot of people have social anxiety, and he's a real, maybe not to the extent that Greinke does, but I think he's been a real, I don't want to call him a role model because he would hate that, but I think it's been inspirational to see that he took something that was debilitating. He got treated, he got help for it, he got medication, and then he's back, and look, he's probably going to win another Cy Young this year.
Right, and it seems, I mean, all that stuff happened so long ago. I know everyone still brings it up with Greinke because that's the only thing that people want to talk about, but it's been so long since that happened, and he's been so great and consistent as a pitcher.
I mean, unfortunately, we still have a lot of a long way to go as far as different stigmas surrounding mental health. But I mean, what I love about him is that he said, you know, I went out, I got diagnosed, they gave me medication, and far from being embarrassed about it, he wishes he had known about it sooner. You know, he wishes that he had known as a teenager or a pre-teenager, an adolescent, that what it was, and that he had gone on so off at that point, because he recognized that it was pointless to suffer needlessly. And I love that, because especially with men, I think men can feel really, really embarrassed about the stigma attached to that. When it's nothing to be ashamed of at all. It's just faulty wiring. It's nobody's fault.
It seems like maybe before you had sat down with Greinke, there was maybe some concern that maybe he wouldn't be so open or willing to talk to you. Was that maybe the biggest challenge with writing this book, or just getting the players to want to participate, or were there other things that were a little more difficult on your end?
Well, I think for me, it's just hard to write a book because I'd never done it before. So like, it was just this enormous project. to sit down and think like, how am I going to organize all this? And what if it's terrible and everyone hates it, or no one, or worse, or like no one even cares, no one reads it. The Puig stuff was probably the most challenging because it was really, really hard to stay grounded on it because it was just so insane, all the craziness surrounding him. And it was like every day was just more news and more information to either be outraged by or to be excited by. And there was a lot of breathless hyperbole and teammates getting frustrated. And I sort of had to sit there and go, okay, like everyone deep breath, like, he showed up late today, but did that cost you guys the win? You know, like, is this really that dramatic? And that kind of thing. And that was really hard because he wouldn't talk to me. And so I had to make the effort to sit down with, have dinners with a bunch of his, friends and associates and people that knew what he was thinking to get his perspective. That was definitely the hardest part.
And now that the book is out, what has been the biggest challenge since then? Is it still the Puig stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was upset when it first came out. I was frustrated that people were. I was especially frustrated that there were radio personalities on the Dodgers flagship station, not affiliated with the Dodgers, but on the station that plays the Dodger games, who had not read my book and were trashing it because they just assumed that I was slamming Puig and, you know, that I was some kind of racist and that, like, you know, this is how I was making quick buck, which is hysterical to me because, if I wanted to make a lot of money, I definitely would not have gone into book writing or writing in general. I would have gone, to law school or to Wall Street, like most of my friends from college. But yeah, like that was really frustrating for me. And I was just like, I don't want to say I was devastated by it. I was exhausted by it. I thought it was irresponsible of people, especially who had shows on the Dodgers network who were trashing it and hadn't even read it. And I thought, geez, that would be sort of 101 if all these fans are calling up wanting to know, like, what is this book about? And I had a strong take on it. I would have hoped I would have read it. But yeah, then I realized like there's literally nothing I can do. People who have not read the book hate it or hate me. There's nothing I can do to change their mind on that. But for the most part, it's been incredible, and that sort of all blew over because a lot of my criticizers did read the book, and then they kind of calmed down. Actually, a few of them apologized even, so that was fine. And for the most part, like 99% of the feedback has been outstanding, and people have been very positive, and it's blown me away. So yeah, it's been beyond my wildest dreams.
Before we let you go, I feel like we have to talk about the current state of the club. They're clinging to a lead in the National League West, but things are starting to look pretty tight. What's right. The general sense just being in Los Angeles and following, covering this team right now?
Well, first of all, Dodger fans are in a really dark place right now. And it's not just because it's funny. They've been in first place all year long. And I feel like, you know, 25 other fan bases would trade places with them right now for that. But it's just been this really, really heartbreaking, sour playoff losses that have happened the last 2 years, and fans have just been pretty negative and pretty, it's been building for a while. And so fans act as though they're in last place and they're terrible, which is kind of funny to me because they still have two of the best pitchers in the world. And I do think that if they can hold the Giants off and make the World Series or sorry, make the playoffs, not the World Series, but that would be nice too. Make the playoffs. I think Kershaw and Greinke will annihilate the competition. And it's funny because they might go from sort of, you know, butt sliding their way in to then, you know, dominating and making the World Series or winning it, kind of like how the Giants did last year with Bumgarner. You know, they've got two Bumgarners really. But yeah, it's been a mess, and Puig hasn't been good this year. Jock Peterson has been in a horrendous slump for the last 2 months, and their bullpen has just been atrocious. The bullpen, they're super volatile. I don't know what to say about it. I thought this bullpen was going to be better. I think they have potential, and they have the stuff, but there are a lot of young guys, and they don't seem they seem to sort of, I don't know if it's a mental thing or if they just can't throw that breaking ball for a first pitch strike. I'm not sure what it is, but yeah, Kershaw and Greinke are going to have to go, have to get the ball to Kenley just like last year. And they weren't able to do that in the playoffs, and it cost them. So they're going to have to figure out how to do it this year.
So there's panic right now, but you still think this is a playoff team?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I think that, I think that the Giants are flawed also, and they're dealing with injuries right now, and they need these guys. They need Panic and Pence, and they need some of the guys from the rotation to come back. And part of it is people say, oh, the Giants are playing poorly right now. It's like, well, no, they had four games in Pittsburgh and three games in St. Louis last week, and we knew that was going to be the week of death. Now they've got the Cubs tonight. They're in a horrendous part of their schedule. The Dodgers had a much tougher schedule up to this point, and so in a way they have an advantage. If they can win these games against Cincinnati and go back home, they'll be in a better position. But yeah, I never count the Giants, so it should be an exciting ride. Yeah. And also the Diamondbacks are only like 5 games out right now, which is hilarious to me. But they've got the Cardinals coming in, so they're not going to be there for long.
All right, well, Molly, I really appreciate this. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about the book. Like I said, I loved it. And where else can we find you on the internet or just your articles?
Yeah, sure. So I'm on Twitter at Molly_Knight. I'm still finishing up the promotion for this book, but I write cover stories for Self Magazine, which is a women's magazine about like health and fitness stuff and celebrities and different stuff. But yeah, I can't say where I'm going to be next yet. I'm not ready to announce it, but you guys will know soon.
All right. Great. Molly, again, really appreciate you taking the time. You guys are listening to the Stew Pod. We'll be right back. Thanks again to Molly Knight for taking the time to talk to us about her book, The Best Team Money Can Buy. We are back on the Stew Pod, Chris Swick with Craig Goldstein. And Craig, I hope you're excited for the important question segment.
I can barely contain
it. It is sweeping the nation. Everyone's talking about the important question. And this is what I have for you today. I know because I follow you on Twitter that you are a big fan of the show House Hunters.
Oh, God, no.
So I am hoping that you will give us a power ranking of each House Hunters show. Now, there are a lot of them, so I
had... When did they all happen?
Well, I don't know. They just showed up. I took some notes here, and I have four main ones for you to rank, and then there's two kind of extra ones that I'm not familiar with. So we have House Hunters, the original version, House Hunters International, House Hunters Off the Grid, and then Tiny House Hunters. Those would be my main four. The two that I haven't seen enough of to rank would be House Hunters Renovation and House Hunters on Vacation. I don't know what those are. And I don't want to know what those are, actually.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
All right, so what's your, from most watchable to least watchable, where are you going?
Okay, so the thing about House Hunters is that it's almost, I don't really know anyone who watches it out of like joy. it's just like a sense of hatred, but I guess the joy is in hating people. But that's certainly how I end up watching it. I just want to see like what stupid thing these people are going to say next. I think the most watchable is House Hunters International. You're at least going somewhere different where like you're not necessarily familiar with the region. So there's, I guess, maybe less things to immediately criticize. But then the people are generally so unreasonable with their expectations that it's I don't know. It's that yin and yang kind of thing, right? Like that. You don't know more than them, and yet you still know that they're complete morons.
Right.
So I think that's the first one. I've only seen about 3 episodes of Tiny House Hunters, but I think I'm going to put it second.
Wow, I'm surprised.
Yeah. Well, again, I said, you hate watch it. And so these people are, first of all, I apologize. I don't even apologize to any Tiny House fanatics out there. Like you're crazy, because why would you choose to live in 134 square feet of space is one thing. That's the first thing, right? Mm-hmm. But then the people who are looking for home, for these tiny houses, then it's like one of the first things that they do is like, the first one I saw, the woman wanted a bathtub in her tiny house. And now maybe I'm not familiar with enough with the tiny house movement, but the idea is to conserve space, and you'd think everything needs to be more efficient. I think we all know showers are more efficient in terms of space, and yet she wanted to dedicate a significant portion of her small house to a bathtub. And then on top of it, like, she just threw this in at the end, and this blew my mind. She was like, that's great. I want a bathtub, and I'm going to be in there with, not in the bathtub, but in the house with my mastiff.
Right.
Which I think is grounds for arrest. Like, I don't think you should be, first of all, a tiny house for a mastiff makes sense. Just the mastiff.
Yes.
Like, that makes sense. So I think, like, just the sheer lunacy of the tiny house hunters is pushing it to number two for me.
I'm going to assume that you would go, you're going original third and then off the grid last, right?
That's correct.
Cause off the grid is nuts.
It's the worst. Someone adopted a howler monkey at the end of one. Yeah. I saw.
And the one of them that I watched, they had a composting toilet, which is like the scariest.
They talked about that. Wait a minute. They talked about that in the Tiny House Hunters where she wanted a bathtub.
Yeah. I just, that's the worst combination of words, I think, possible. So,
it's like, you know, your favorite prospect needs Tommy John surgery or a composting toilet. It's right. One of the other.
Yes. All right. Well, I think that's going to do it. Craig, thanks for doing this. And, also, congrats to you for surviving.
Thank you.
Nice work.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it, and I hope everyone hates me.
Yes, and we can read your work on Baseball Prospectus. We can read your power rankings at Fox Sports. We can follow.
Yeah.
Yes, we can follow you on Twitter at
CD Goldstein.
And if you want more terrible opinions from Craig, you can follow him there. That's it for the StuPod this week. Mike Oz should be back next week. Thanks for listening, everybody.